From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made with a question. What is effective when it comes to getting people to address climate change? Is it a moral or ethical case? Is it economic? Is it political? In a new op-ed, the CEO of a local energy company says it's time to remove politics and morality from the conversation about climate action. Kevin Schulte is the CEO of GreenSpark Solar. He writes, quote, "I believe climate change is a monumental catastrophe that awaits humanity if we do not act urgently." But he adds, quote, "I am discouraged because the discussion around climate change and the proposed responses and solutions has fallen into a discussion of politics, a set of questions around morality, and an overwhelmingly divisive discourse. So we have to elevate the level of dialogue to bring people together and not alienate them. We need to relate solutions to an individual's or business's daily life and economics and remove morality and politics," end quote. Is he right? Schulte believes that the vast majority of human beings are going to be more receptive to a pragmatic discussion of their financial well-being, their economic plight and future, and the positive economic advances that can come from climate action. Is that a better way to handle this discussion? Is it time to stop shaming or discussing morality or just the right or wrong things to do when it comes to leaders like Greta Thunberg? Kevin says she's amazing. She's right. And he doubts she's converted one person to her cause. Well, we've invited him to come in and debate this with guests from various backgrounds. So in studio, let me welcome the rabble-rouser. First, Kevin Schulte is the CEO of GreenSpark Solar. Welcome. Nice to have you back here.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Also with us is Professor Lawrence Torricello, who is an associate professor in the Departments of Philosophy at RIT. Welcome back. Thank you for being here, Professor.
Always good to be here.
Also with us is Sue Hughes-Smith, Go All Electric Program Manager for the Rochester People's Climate Coalition and an environmental educator herself. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
And Ben Freebird is a partner at Rocktricity, among other titles. Welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Evan.
It's not that Kevin Schulte doesn't think there is a moral case for climate action. It's that you think it no longer works. Is that fair?
It is. It is my thought, and it's my career, right? So I've been doing this my whole life. Since I was 18 years old, I've been involved in climate change and renewable energy and all of the sort of solutions to it. And I think I've recently reflected on, I myself am a person that has been known to have a strong opinion. And I've expressed that, and I don't know that it's helped. And I've been in this game for now more than 20 years, and I'm not sure those strong opinions have converted people to my side of the argument. And so I am backtracking on that and trying to find ways to get people on board. And we find ever increasingly that the conversation is one about financials and economics. And our reality now is that when I started in this business in wind energy in the late 90s, people looked at me like I had lobsters coming out of my ears. You're going to do what? You're going to put up wind turbines and make it? They didn't have any idea. And they believed it was the Rachel Carson era of the 60s and 70s where any environmental solution was more expensive. We do not live in that world. We live in a world where many environmental solutions, from organic food choices to renewable electricity, et cetera, are actually better and cheaper than the alternative, the dirtier alternative. And we should make sure that people understand, we should be educating and teaching to those effects and not questioning whether or not they should make that decision based on some moral compass question around their choices.
Now, I want to explore a little bit more with Kevin before I turn it over to our guest to interrogate him on this and where they agree or disagree. So a couple of points here. I mentioned at the outset, someone like Greta Thunberg, who has become a worldwide name and a force in leading this kind of a movement. You don't think she's really converted anybody?
I think she's galvanized people that understand the problem, are engaged in the problem, and she's brought that conversation to the forefront for that group of people. But I'm worried that when you question, you know, some of the things she says is about how, you know, people that have done wrong are harming her generation and the ones to follow. And I'm not sure I disagree with that on any level. But I also don't necessarily believe that that will get that person to change their mindset and actually adopt something that is helpful in mitigating the potential disasters of climate change.
Realistically, be blunt. What do you think people who are sort of have been obstinately opposed to the idea that either climate change is real or that we can do anything or should do anything about it, when they hear Greta Thunberg, what do you think they hear?
I think they tune her out. I think they hear a child that's questioning, a young person that's questioning them, and likely tune them that out. And that saddens me. Don't get me wrong, because I think she's amazing, and I think what she's doing is very powerful. But I think that the gains that are to be made in our society are by converting, I don't know what the right term is, but people that aren't currently engaged in making both environmental and economic decisions that improve all of our circumstance.
You told a story before the hour began that I'd like you to tell now in as much detail as you can about a customer that might have been an unlikely customer of yours.
Yeah. So last year, well after the 2016 election, I was driving down the road. It's actually the same road that I live on, and there's a sign up that is a large, you know, Trump sign. And this business recently came to us and signed a contract with us to go solar. So this is not a person that believes necessarily in climate change. This is not a person that necessarily shares many of my beliefs. But they came to us and they said, we want to understand what are the potential economic benefits for us in going solar. And we very clearly explained the economics. We didn't once talk about the environmental benefits. We didn't once talk about those things because you can tell in this dialogue that this is not going to help this person make this choice. What will help this person make this choice is that solar is a better, cheaper alternative than paying your electricity bill. That is the case for all electricity consumers. And he was able to see that, you know, in a financial pro forma and say, this is a strong business decision. I should make it. And so we're now moving forward with, you know, a seven-figure style solar project.
Do you think you could have lost him as a customer if you would have sort of interjected and said, and by the way, you're doing this for your kids and their kids, and this is the right thing to do?
I do.
You could have lost him.
I do believe that, yes.
That's a powerful statement. And generally speaking, when it comes to discussing anything, you have come to believe, as you write, that if you enter a conversation telling someone that their values are wrong, you're going to lose them immediately?
Correct. Correct.
What if you really believe their values are wrong?
It's not my disposition to let them know. The same as I'm not going to question your faith if you're a Jewish person or a Muslim person or a Catholic person. That's not meaningful to me.
But what if their values are hurting people?
My goal would be then to give them a course of action that could improve upon their actions would improve that they are no longer hurting people.
Would you agree with this idea that when it comes to climate action, if it were truly more onerous and expensive, but it was the only way to preserve the planet for most species, including ours, that we would have to rely on the moral case? But it just so happens that there is also an economic case, and you think that that is now more powerful.
I think that's the point that we're at, right? I think for the last 20 years that hasn't been the case, and like I said earlier, people viewed, you know, renewable energy or whatever as, you know, we're still in the 70s and it costs five times as much, and because that's no longer the case, yes, I believe that the economic benefits can drive adoption far more than any other argument around why to do it.
And so before I turn it over to the other guests, what would you say to those who are part of these movements, who hold banners, think about your children, you know, the moral case in various ways and presentations? Is your message to them that you admire and may respect them, but you don't think it's going to be very effective going forward?
No, I think so. I think, as Sue said in our dialogue before, social movements are born by making a statement on what you believe is right, and I believe that those people should continue and that they're doing a good thing. I think from a business perspective, we need to make the case on the economics. And frankly, I think this is a really big 30,000-foot dialogue around shifting the fundamental economic understandings in our society that environmental choices cost more. If you listen to why the political right is okay with exiting the Paris Climate Accord, as a for instance, it's because of how much money it's going to cost us. There is not one evidentiary piece of documentation anywhere that shows that converting to renewable energy is going to cost this country or anyone else money. The reality is it's going to make tremendous investment opportunity, tremendous job growth, tremendous economic returns. And we're sitting here in 30-year-old thinking saying this is going to cost us money. It is such a false argument.
No, I hear you. In a lot of sense, in a lot of cases, you have, generally speaking, conservatives or people on the political right who have shifted from saying climate change is not real to saying it is real, but doing something about it would destroy us economically.
Yeah.
And so you're trying to make the counter argument, but I'm gonna accuse you of one dodge here, okay? And feel free to push back. Let's have a little fun with this.
I will dodge nothing.
Okay. If you truly believe that the case made by, sure, Greta, but also often RPCC, activists and advocates everywhere, is potentially backfiring or even pushing people who would be on the fence out, doesn't that jeopardize, can you really do both? And what, I guess what I mean is, think about the customer you just talked about, a seven-figure buy of solar solely on economics, knowing that you could have lost him if you would have tried to do the approach that others have done. Now, if he is thinking about this, he had a good conversation with you, and he turns on the news that night, and he sees a march of a million people in New York City, and they're telling him that he's destroying the planet, he might say, you know what, Kevin, you know, screw it. I'm not doing this. Don't you think you could lose them?
I think, and the professor of psychology or philosophy or whatever we are might know better
ethics,
than I.
Ethics, philosophy,
yeah,
all of those things. Yeah.
I think that we... There's a lot of ignorance, there's a lot of bliss, there's a lot of and there's a lot of opportunity in people's mindsets, right? And my guess is that the customer has spent their time blissfully thinking, I'm not really causing a problem. I believe that that person likely in some part makes that choice because he knows he's doing right by the environment, potentially for his children and his grandchildren. But I can tell you that I do not believe me forcing or bringing that argument to that conversation in any way advocates for a business decision to actually take real action. And so I'm not attempting to dodge it. I'm attempting to impart business opportunities and economic opportunities into society that allow people to make decisions through that potential moral and political conflict that they may have.
Okay. Professor Torricello, let's start with you. What do you make of his argument?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. One could make an argument that everything that Kevin just said is, in fact, a moral position that he's putting forward, insofar as it's very difficult to separate ourselves from ethics and ideology associated with ethics. The customer that Kevin describes, I have no doubt, if he were to make the decision that he no longer wanted to go ahead with this contract, would have, in his mind, be making an ethical decision based upon what he thinks is right to do along with his political commitments. I think the question isn't whether or not ethics works. I think the question is how to get the correct message across that's consistent with the ethical realities of our situation regarding climate change and also pragmatic enough to get things accomplished to serve those ethical goals.
So interestingly, the pragmatic approach may itself be ethical.
For sure. Yeah.
If it's more effective. It is on its own... Yeah. An ethical approach.
Yeah, and the ethical approach may be pragmatic in many situations. Mm-hmm. I think that if you're in the circumstances that Kevin is talking about and that he deals with on a daily basis, I would agree that it's probably not the best idea for him to attempt to browbeat people into entering these contracts based on moral guilt or something like that. when you take somebody like Greta Thunberg, I think that she probably likely has converted people. I think just because of the sheer statistics and large numbers involved, given the media coverage that she's had. And whether or not Kevin has in the past ever converted anyone is hard to tell. As somebody who teaches people for a living, I know that not everything I say in the moment is going to sink in, but revisit them in another year or two, or even by the end of the semester. We don't change our minds immediately, which is to say that, of course, I think that morality has a place in this dialogue and is also very effective. But I think we have to be smart about it, and we have to respect each other and realize that many people who seemingly hold an opposite view that we consider immoral may have that opposite view grounded in their own sense of morality. And in fact, what we're dealing with is a moral difference here. So there's no escaping morality. We have to learn how to bridge those moral distinctions.
We're going to return to that later this hour as we talk more about values and when it is appropriate to challenge or to debate them and when you might lose people. I think that's a fascinating point there. But I also want to remember as long as I possibly can the point the professor just made, which is that too often I think we make this assumption that people who hold different values just must be doing so because they're trolls or evil, as opposed to thinking that their values are correct and that they are assuming that they are also moral people and that their minds may be open to change, but ours probably ought to be open to hearing them and changing too. So really interesting stuff. Sue Hugh Smith, do you agree that it is the better course of action now to focus on economics as far and widely as possible?
The better course of action? I don't know that I would say that.
The more effective way to convert people from here on forward.
I think there, for many people, the economic argument makes a lot of sense. The economic argument is not that doing what's good for the environment is what's economically smart is not a new argument, however. In fact, you go way back to Reagan. Why did Reagan sign the Montreal Protocol to protect us from depleting the stratospheric ozone layer? It was because he asked his economic advisors, what's this going to cost us to act? What's it going to cost us not to act? And the conclusion was it cost us less to do something about the problem. The same has been true for climate change for decades. It's never not been true. What is happening is that there is a politicization, I can't say that word well, of the conversation, because those who benefit the most from continuing to use fossil fuels want to continue using fossil fuels. The overall economy, like Kevin says, will do great if we switch to renewable energy. Every time we transition to a new energy source, the overall economy grows. But there will be some very particular losers in that conversation, and they don't want to lose. So I don't think it's about converting the individual people of the masses. It's about forcing the political decision makers. There's a handful of people in this world who have the ability to influence the direction of, quite frankly, the fate of humanity. And that's who Greta Thunberg is talking to. That's who people who protest on the street are talking to. If you want to convert your neighbor, yeah, it's probably not the best conversation to have. So the audience matters. What is it that we're defining here?
But 2 points here. Yeah. On the subject of educating, You've made this point, and I think it's, I know you make it because it's an important one for us to remember in historical frame, which is that every time we have changed energy systems, it has been largely productive and beneficial to the economy. Mm-hmm. Now, there are particular losers. On the education, on the politics side, Kevin's arguing we got to take politics out. Mm-hmm. But isn't that historical fact that you're bringing up an argument for keeping politics in, just to say we need to educate about politics and say that the people with the political power are often the one who are trying to keep the status quo, because they hold the power, they hold the economic power, and they don't want to see this change. And they're trying to convince, through politics and other means, that what we know to be true is false. Isn't that an argument to keep politics as part of this conversation?
I don't see how you don't have at least policy as a part of the conversation. And because policy is conveyed to us through political terms, I don't see how you ever escape it. But to me, we have to be honest. Both sides and everyone involved needs to be honest. The Democrats may talk a good game, but they haven't done a whole lot. And the Republicans tend to outright dismiss that climate change is happening. So whose burden is it to bridge the divide? Everybody's burden. You know, the reality is that there are a lot of Republicans who want to do the right thing because it makes economic sense, health sense, et cetera, to do the right thing.
But this is where I go back to Kevin's point. Mm-hmm. Kevin is talking about his interaction with customers. What we do know is that markets respond to, you know, surges of economic activity. And if we had a society in which even people who aren't all that worried about climate change as a priority on the moral side or even believing that it's real, if you convince them all that going solar at home, at business, or pushing for energy change is good for them, they may do it anyway, apart from the moral case, apart from the political case. They may just say, hey, I'm going to save more money or make more money. And that pressure goes upwards. So then, now you're not waiting for leaders at the top politically or CEOs to make the decisions. They're responding to demand. And Kevin's indication is, we got to stop the browbeating in the moral case. It doesn't work. We got to stay on economics. Is that persuasive?
I think it is. I think for a lot of people it is. And it has to be a part of the conversation. Absolutely. And the whole point of go all electric is that we all need to envision what does our world look like without fossil fuels, and we need to make that happen. And then the how do we make that happen is where the stickiness comes in the conversation. But people have to envision where we're going first, and then they need to understand the benefits of doing it. And sure, maybe that grows demand because they start purchasing more solar energy. Maybe it helps them pick up the phone call, the phone, and call their leader and say, well, we want these other policies that are going to make that more possible for me to go all electric.
Before the hour began, Ben Frevert was making an interesting observation that, yes, social movements can produce change, but there may be sort of a natural limitation to what is persuadable in terms of the general population. Where do you think we are when it comes to persuading people to get involved with climate action in whatever sense that may look like? Where do you think we are with using the moral case for that?
Well, I think that the audience available, that's susceptible to that message is shrinking. I think that where that point has been made in the past, that many people have listened to that and have been able to sort out the details and come on side. But I think that those holdouts are much harder to get to. And I think that the economic message that Kevin's talking about on a personal level, I think that's the avenue to proceed with those particular individuals. I don't know the relative size of those two populations, but I think that that's a much smaller population.
Now, and does that then argue for turning down the volume on some of the organized demonstrations we see about climate on the moral side and amping up the volume on the economic side?
I don't think so. Particularly at the political level, I think that the decision makers that we need to get to and talk to and change, I think that their positions on both moral issues and economic issues will change. And I don't think they'll change because I'm going to say anything to them. I think they're going to change as they sense the political winds changing. And I think that political winds are changing. I think we'll see that in coming elections.
This, by the way, is not a conversation about saying, well, this movement is not helpful or Greta Thunberg, whatever. It's about what works. But where do you stand with the idea that Greta Thunberg may not be converting many people?
I think she's probably converting a few, but I think that already that segment of the population that's susceptible to that type of message is shrinking. I think that the people that might be aimed at, that might really be aimed at, that the majority of them are staunchly opposed to doing any making any change. Now, it appears that she's had a significant impact on people, and I think that's true. But I think those people that are behind her and that are really speaking out because she's being so effective, we're already on board with the climate change message.
But they may not have been doing much. They might not have been as active as they are now.
Well, that might be true.
You have 10,000 kids in cities like in Germany who are striking on Fridays, who are not going to school. They weren't doing that in the absence of the attention that Greta was getting and putting on the urgency of this issue. So, I mean, I think she has to be making an impact. Whether that translates into effective policy change remains to be seen. But I think all the evidence is out there that in the absence of a social pressure, we're not getting the change we need, even though it makes financial sense for the broad American public or collective public globally to be making that change.
So to a certain extent, we're debating empirical questions here. And I'm sorry I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's my understanding that general belief in climate change, the fact that it's actually happening and human beings cause it, is on the rise across the American public. And that means that the ethical argument, insofar as it has an impact, as Susan was just saying, and I think you were implying, Evan, with that group of people who already buy in to the idea that climate change is real and human beings are driving it, that's a large, significant segment that ethical arguments will motivate, most likely, I think, to actually begin doing the things that back up the beliefs they already hold. And that's where I think activism and young people going on climate strikes actually has a real impact.
Okay, Kevin?
For what it's worth, I mean, I think what I am hopeful about is that the type of movement that Greta has galvanized and people like her have galvanized is very influential in the sphere of public policy, right? Whether it's at a state level, a national level, or international level, I think that is a wonderful opportunity for social activism to play a very meaningful role. Where I don't necessarily believe there is a meaningful role is with a consumer choice, right? With a consumer's choice to do anything down to like the one that always comes to my mind is celery. Right. You go to Wegmans here in Rochester, you walk in and you go to the right and there's a head of celery, organic celery with no packaging. $1.49 a head. I could go to the left side of the aisle and I could pick out a bagged cut celery that's not organic for $4 a bag. This is a really simple down-home choice that people are not, that we have not as a society ingrained. This is actually a better, cheaper, cleaner alternative on every level. And we go for the convenience factor of the fact that this is packaged pretty and that's what I want to take home. And those are the types of decisions from the most simple things we do on a daily basis, switching off the light switch when we leave the room. Those are the types of decisions that we need to create the dialogue around how impactful they are in climate change.
In a moment, I'm going to get some feedback from listeners, but one more for Kevin and the professor on this question. One of our listeners brings up the subject of evolution. Evolutionary changes in species don't happen for moral reasons. We didn't even evolve our big brain for moral reasons. We didn't evolve opposable thumbs for moral reasons. Do we need to see, it's about survival, obviously. It's about survival and thriving. Do we need to understand that, Kevin, and say that if we're going to survive and thrive understanding energy feedback and climate change, we may not get that far making the moral case, and we may need to understand why we have evolved in the way we have evolved?
I think so. I mean, I think that's the core of what the paper I wrote is trying to say is, like, bring this back to a decision that everyone knows impacts them every day, which is how many dollars do they have in their wallet? How many dollars do they have in their bank account? And when you bring that back, when you ingrain that in societal thinking and in decision-making of consumers on a daily basis, you win. So if you're going to continue to push that purchase of celery or flipping off the light switch and say, hey, you're a bad guy for not switching off that light switch, like, that person's not going to listen. They're going to do it because they eventually realize it benefits them. And so you have to bring that benefit to them. And to your point on surviving and thriving, the economy drives that large in part. And so to me, that's where that all comes back and sort of circles around and ties together.
Professor Torchello?
Well, we really wouldn't be talking about climate change at all if it wasn't an ethical issue. we would just be talking about efficient economics. The reason we care about climate change is because it impacts life on the planet and creates needless suffering. And there, by the way, is an evolutionary benefit to ethical behavior. So the framing of the question aside, as was sent in to you, it's just a fact that we survive better as a species together, acting in reciprocal ways that benefit ourselves. And so morality has a purpose. I wouldn't reduce morality to evolution exclusively, but they're not totally unrelated concepts either. But I don't know, if I have some time, I would like to just mention that, again, going back to the empirical sense of this, there have been studies done on what actually does move people. And there's a lot of research out there that talks about how we're locked into our ideological spheres, and that's under a heading of what psychologists have called the cultural cognition model. And that's a problem that I think we're all familiar with, the idea that the more we try to make the moral case to someone who's ideologically opposed to where we're coming from, that could have, as studies show, a backfire effect and make them get more, dug into their views. On the other hand, there's also a lot of evidence that shows if you just simply focus on the scientific consensus around climate change, that cuts through a lot of opposition to it as well. And there's also evidence that shows moral framing does work and does move people. And when people feel as if they may have made a moral misstep, they want to correct it. Obviously, that has to be done in a way that doesn't trigger a backfire effect. So this is a complicated area, and there's a lot of research showing that there's more than one thing that's psychologically in play here. All of this, though, comes back to something I want to say regarding an ancient, informal fallacy called the reductio ad absurdum, or argument, I misspoke, not the reductio ad absurdum, but the argument by repetition, argumentum ad nauseum. So the idea here is that when we hear things over and over and over and over again, they gradually sink into our frame of reference, and we remember them more easily. There's an availability bias there. We recall it more easily. And the mere familiarity, and this is what's called the familiarity effect, the mere familiarity effect in psychological literature, I think plays a role here. The more familiar we are with things, the more likely we are to accept them and be comfortable with information. I think that accounts for cultural cognition, the idea that we're influenced by the people that we identify with culturally. And it also accounts for the idea that hearing that there's a climate consensus over and over again, and the more familiar that becomes to us, should make a difference. All of this is to say that we shouldn't be so shy. We should have common sense. I think that Kevin's right. You don't browbeat potential customers when you're running a business that, trades in renewables. But also, we should be comfortable talking about climate change, talking about it, not in a sense to make people feel guilty, but just in the sense that this is something that's real that we're not afraid to speak of. And I think that in and of itself has moral implications that are obvious to people. One of the reasons historically that the right wing has attempted to argue against the science, I think, is because once you accept climate change, the moral implication of it is so obvious that it's in some weird sense easier to attack the science than to attack the ethical arguments that come from climate change actually being the case.
All right, so after our only break of the hour, we're going to take some phone calls, and before the hour's up, we're going to have a little Thanksgiving simulation, because Thanksgiving is coming, less than 3 weeks, and I want to know how Kevin talks to someone across the table. I want to know how the professor and Sue and Ben, what their conversation sounds like for what works in terms of motivating action on climate. We're here because Kevin Schulte wrote a piece about his views on what works and what does not when it comes to motivating climate action. And he says solutions have to relate to individual or businesses' daily life and their economic well-being. And he makes the case that that's the education, that's the advocacy, that's what's going to make change. He's the CEO of GreenSpark Solar, so, hey, he's got a self-interest there, but he's also saying that that's what works and that that's the reality of our shared future. Professor Lawrence Torcello is here from RIT, Sue Hugh Smith from the Rochester People's Climate Coalition, Ben Freevert is a partner at Rocktricity. Your phone calls are next. Coming up in our second hour, the rate of suicide among female veterans is remarkably high, much higher than the rate of suicide in the general population. Why is that? The Flower City Art Center is partnering with women who are veterans, allowing them to tell their stories in a visual way and also with words, writing, and poetry. And you will hear their stories next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Before your phone calls, one more brief point, and it's an important one. Ben and Kevin were musing during our break that, yes, right now we remain a capitalistic society, and there's suspicion that people will have, well, Kevin wrote this piece because he's the CEO of GreenSpark. He wants phone calls and customers, and I'm sure he does. And, you know, Ben works with Rocktricity, and what nefarious money-making group is that, you capitalist thug? What's the story there? What's the reality, Ben?
Well, Rocktricity was born out of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition, and there was a group of us there that were working on trying to encourage municipalities to pursue this policy in, called community choice aggregation. And we saw that as an avenue for communities to move to using greater percentage of renewable energy. But we needed some business entity to be doing this, and it didn't work under RPCC, which is a 501c3. Just too hard to make decisions about to move quickly to buy printers and things like that. So we said, well, let's form our own organization of some sort. What should we do? Well, the easiest and quickest thing to do is to be an LLC. We send in the paperwork and we're an LLC almost immediately. I mean, it's just super quick and easy. That's the easiest way to do it. Okay, so now we have this business. We're able to go out into the community and
do what
we're trying
to do. I was told it's impossible to do business in this state.
well, we're not making any money, so maybe that's right. I don't know. but we're able to actually go out and interact with the other organizations that we need to interact with and do some sort of business to try to promote CCA. And we're able to be effective. But as soon as we tell, often, not always, but for some people, as soon as they say, well, what is this Rocktricity? We say, well, this is a business where, you know, businesses are designed to make money. We're an LLC. That's the way it's all set up. They quickly have a reaction that, oh, you guys are here trying to sell us something.
And they don't trust you anymore.
Exactly. The level of trust drops among a certain part of the population. Not everybody reacts to that. Some people know this dynamic.
What do you get, Kevin?
Well, the setting that we would hear this conversation is like in a public hearing around a solar project we might be building, where someone will talk about our self-interest and they're going to make a profit on this project, and sort of that's a negative light they're trying to shed on me and my business. Well, yeah, we're trying to make a profit. We are. We are a for-profit business trying to build solar, and we think that that's a good thing. So we'll hear that as one of those arguments as to why we may be self-interested in putting solar panels on what was, you know, previously ag land or something to that effect.
No, it's interesting. Some of the opprobrium about changing energy systems is, oh, I see, you just want the government to do everything. You know, that's a socialist thing. But now it's like, oh, so this is just a capitalist thing. Everybody's upset. But there's money to be made. That's the point that's being made here. All right, to your phone calls we go, and we're going to try to keep it as tight as we can. Rob, first in Pittsford. Hello, Rob.
Oh, hi, Kevin. Evan, thanks for having me on. Hi, Sue. It's Rob Levine from Citizens Climate Lobby. I've been chewing my fingernails for the last 45 minutes because I could comment on this for an hour easily. I think Sue can attest to that. So I'll try to be brief in a few points. I agree with Kevin that those who haven't made the moral connection in their minds, it's going to be hard to get them to do it if they haven't done so at this point. And the work that I've done going out to try to get municipal leadership and business leaders to support legislation that can help move this along. Clearly, the economics have become the biggest driver of that. So I agree with Kevin in that sense. When people talk about self-interest of solar, what do they think the fossil fuel companies are in this for? I mean, that just, you know, drives me out of my mind. The other thing is that Kevin is looking at it from a purely business sense, where it makes sense for him to only focus on the economics to do what he's doing. And the work he's doing is fantastic. The problem is the work he's doing is one business at a time. And the solutions that we need to reach the IPCC goals in now 10 and a half years that we have left are only going to be accomplished through massive and sweeping change in our economy. And the only way to get massive sweeping change from fossil fuels to renewable fuels is going to be through government and political action. There's just no other way for solutions that large to be done without intergovernmental help.
Okay.
I think most people understand that, right? So the politics cannot be abandoned. And the work that we do as volunteers in this community is to get political action. For instance, H.R. 763, we've talked about before, to put a fee on carbon so that people will move to Kevin's business model that much faster. Kevin can't do it one company at a time, and neither can Rocktricity do it one small community at a time.
All right,
this has to be sweeping, transformational change, and the only way to do that is through government action. I'm sorry, I'm not a huge fan of government either in certain cases, but in other cases, where would we be without it?
Yeah.
So I really believe you're missing the point if you don't think that lobbying for political action is not the most significant work we can do. Marching in the streets is great, but if a million people who march in the streets go back to their lives the next day, it doesn't do us any good. I agree with Kevin on that. But if a dozen of those people join an organization like RPCC, CCL, and start getting active, maybe, just maybe, we can make the changes we need to make in time to stave off the worst effects of climate change. And personally, I believe we have a moral obligation to do that. But economically, it is by far the cheapest thing we can do is to try to solve this problem as fast as possible, because the expense grows every day there's another hurricane. And as I said, I could speak on this for another 20
well,
minutes.
Well, I believe you can.
So other people... Go ahead.
No, let me jump in, Rob, and just say, you're getting the phone call to be on the next panel that we talk about this.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm eager. Yeah. There's no doubt about that.
Well, I appreciate it as always, Rob. Thank you so much. And let's focus on Rob's central point, Kevin, which is that he admires you, Rocktricity, GreenSpark, et cetera, but you can't change this world fast enough, one company, one project at a time.
Anyone that knows me knows that I'm nowhere near that, right? We've done policy work in Washington. We've done policy work in Albany. Just next week, I'll be taking a group that I'm on the board of called the Amicus Solar Cooperative, which is a group of 55 independently owned solar companies from around the country. I'll be taking their CEOs, 55 of them, to Washington, D.C. to go lobby and get the investment tax credit passed and extended for solar, EV storage, electric vehicles and storage. The point is absolutely acute. Government needs to push these changes. So I don't question whether or not we need to act in a public policy sphere. But I will tell you that the messaging that my team will take to the Hill next week is about driving economic change and how that may influence a politician's decision to support or not support a piece of public policy.
That's fair enough. The bottom line is, it sounds like you want a broader understanding at every level of society that this is a moneymaker.
Correct. And if I could just add one thing, if we're going to be successful, we have to play the game. Politics in this country are governed from the center, and we have to get rational climate policy advanced at every level of government that matriculates this path forward. If we go to Washington next week and ask for a carbon tax, that won't happen. But there are meaningful climate policies that can be enacted in the short term that move the ball forward, and we need to focus on playing the game to move it forward.
Maybe we need a whole separate hour on how to have these conversations at Thanksgiving. Maybe we'll do it Thanksgiving week. Linda in Penfield. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I'll try and be brief. In my experience, when I've chatted with folks across the ideological aisle about any topic, it could be immigration or sexism, racism, climate change, I have found that the personal story behind what people believe or what people think or how people vote is very telling, and to share my story. And I guess I'm being very micro, that I think it is one person at a time, but people vote, right? And so they're the folks who will get up to that macro, that big government change, I believe. And my personal story is that I grew up 7 miles from Love Canal and remember when all that was going on. And the subsidiary plant had a factory in my hometown. You know, I kind of have a vested interest in what the environment looks like. And if we are going to get political, we have to go out into those areas that are resistant to hearing about climate change and talking to people one-on-one. It's great to march downtown. We're visible and all that, but we can't preach to the choir anymore. We've got to get out to those areas that, you know, to the unconverted, basically. So thanks for taking my call.
Thanks very much. I appreciate that. I mean, I don't know that our panel necessarily disagrees. I think one-on-one conversations is, to the extent that you can do it, it's a great idea. And it, I mean, sometimes it involves a lot of patience, but I appreciate the effort, Linda. Thank you. Mike in Rochester next. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi. I own a business, and I was listening to you, and I think it's a combination of both moral and business decisions. I've wanted to do solar for a long time, but I've had to wait until it made sense business-wise so that I can provide employment for my employees. That's a big responsibility, and for my family. So I think it's almost a two-prong attack.
Okay, yeah, thanks, Mike. Makes sense to our panel. What do you think?
Yeah.
I think the argument's different for every business. You know, some businesses can make this decision on a purely on a business case and can have the capital to put a solar project into play immediately. Others have to analyze it, as our caller did, and wait until the timing is right because they might not be able to jump in at any point in time.
Evan, I want to make a shameless plug.
Yeah.
So RPCC, obviously we're an umbrella organization of many other member groups, and so we all are coming at how do we solve climate change from different angles. And we try to view the climate movement as kind of an ecosystem, if you will, where you have different entities that are playing necessary and different roles. Maybe that's marching in the street. Maybe it's having one-on-one conversations. Maybe it's lobbying for policy. But that all of these things have to be integrated together in order to move the dial. And if that is something you want to find your place in that movement, join us on November 16th at the Rochester Museum and Science Center for our plug-in and power-up event from noon to 5, where you can dig into exploring how you might become a climate advocate.
One more time, date, time, place?
Yeah, Saturday, November 16th, the Rochester Museum and Science Center from noon to 5. You can pre-register on Facebook or at RPCC's website, or you can just show up.
Eric says, the economic arguments didn't work in the 1990s, when we all knew this was a problem even then, because major political donors in the fossil fuel industry seized control of the discussion. Here we are nearly 30 years later with essentially zero movement on the issue, in part because the generation most responsible for climate change was preventing action for economic reasons. A strong moral argument is necessary now more than ever, as young people like Greta Thunberg have two advantages. Their moral righteousness is motivating them, and for the first time in 30 years or more, the youth finally control the plurality of the vote. If they turn out. Moral arguments drive turnout. Economics be damned. From Eric. Kevin, what do you think?
I think that this conversation maybe wrongfully placed me in a place where I don't think all ships rise together, for what it's worth. Because I am firmly a believer that all ships rise together and that everybody needs to keep doing their part. And Greta and Sue and Ben and everybody are doing that. So I don't want anybody to think that. But I think part of what, and maybe I didn't articulate it well in the piece I wrote or today, part of what I'm trying to suggest is exactly the contrary to the point of the person that sent that message in, which is we have to change the whole conversation around the economics of this stuff because it is better and cheaper in most cases. And that's where that 1990s thinking, that 1970s thinking continues to be pervasive. And that's the switch. It was a morally strong argument to be made 40 or 50 years ago. It's the same morally strong argument that needs to be made today. The difference is we can adopt the solution, small or big, and benefit ourselves. right? Both environmentally and economically. That's the difference.
Professor Torricello, as we close the program, are you moved to kind of change your approach at all this Thanksgiving?
Well, I'm lucky that I spent Thanksgiving with a group of people that largely agree with my views. But
oh, so you're bubbling. I see. No, I'm mostly kidding. 30 seconds. What do you take from this, though?
Well, I'll plug a book that was just released by a friend of mine who's also been on the show, Robert Talese, who teaches at Vanderbilt University, just published a book called let me call it up, Overdoing Democracy, Why We Must Put Politics in its Place. I think the message of that is that we shouldn't feel obligated to argue with our family all the time, that sometimes the best thing to do is to build our relationships up so we could have real communication by not starting off arguing all the time. So feel free not to argue this Thanksgiving.
Let's come back and talk, though, before the holiday, because these conversations, it's so interesting to think about what's effective. And Kevin Schulte, CEO of Green Spark Solar, got us thinking and talking. And for that, I'm grateful. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Online where? Where can people learn more about what you do?
GreensparkSolar.com.
Okay. Sue Hughes-Smith will see all of you 2 Saturdays from now, 8 days from now, at the plug-in event.
Sounds great.
Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
And Ben Frevert, partner at Rocktricity, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me here.
And Professor Torricello, I'm going to talk to you about your values offline here. I'm going to get you. More coming up here.